Welcome to another episode of At the Table with Patrick Lencioni, where everything we talk about is related to organizational health and the world of work. I'm your host, Pat Lencioni, joined by a truckload of people.
I've got bunches of them.
I've got Cody and Bo and Tracy in studio, but Tracy's not on the mic. And Karen's here. Matt, he's here, our producer. And we are joined by about 50 table group principal consultants from all over the world. We want to say hello to them. This is our first live podcast we've ever done. We're at our annual consulting conference, and they said, let's do a podcast. We want to hear about a topic. And what is that topic, Cody?
What did we just title this? The Forgotten First Book.
That's right. Live.
Live.
The Forgotten First Book. A lot of people don't know. In fact, people in this room didn't know that the first book I ever wrote was The Five Temptations of a CEO. I even paused because I'm like, am I going to get that right? And they said, we've never really done this on the podcast. A lot of these consultants that work with clients all over the world talk about that and use that, but we've never really addressed it, probably because we forgot about it. And so we're going to talk about the very first book we wrote, and that's what we're going to do today.
And I want to get into the content, Pat, but I actually think I remember this story because I wasn't here when you wrote this, obviously, but you sort of tongue-in-cheek say, well, I wrote this book. Why did you write it? And you said, you kind of answered that question with, well, I needed a prop to bring to our clients. Like, you wanted something that you could actually set on the desk and rather than just bring in your markers and flip chart.
Right. Although I didn't say I should write a book. What happened was, but that's partially correct. What happened was I came up with this theory working with a handful of CEOs, and then I just shared it with somebody. I had no idea I was going to write a book about it. And people started to repeat it back to me over the course of like a year. And this one pro bono client I was working with said, hey, you got to write a book about that. And I said, well, I don't know if I'm going to do that. And they said, well, somebody else is going to write that book. Mm. And so I said, okay, I'm going to do it. And then, but the question that you're getting to is that we didn't think it would ever get published. Mm-hmm. We were going to take it to Kinko's and make copies of it just so we could walk around and give it to clients. And then Amy's brother's girlfriend's friend worked at a publishing firm, you know, the old classic story, and said, yeah, I'll read it. And then she sent it to her and she never did. So she called her one day and said, are you going to read that? And she said, I'll read it tonight. And the next day she called and said, we want to meet him. We want to publish this. Mm-hmm. And we were like, that is awesome. Mm-hmm. And that was The Five Temptations of a CEO. We had no idea that we'd ever write another book. And here we are.
And when we were talking about the content, a lot of it sounded familiar. I've not read the book. I had not heard you give a speech about it.
How long have you worked here now, Bo?
2.5 years.
All right. Good, good.
Yeah.
That's the year three book, Kevin.
That's the year three book. And it was so interesting. It's going to sound familiar. Folks are familiar with your content because it's kind of along similar lines. And it was convicting as you went through these five temptations that a CEO and probably all leaders experience to some degree or another, that we are tempted towards these things.
That's right. And I do think people can relate to it. And now we called it The Five Temptations of a CEO and not a leader. And this is interesting for the people in this room because we wanted it to be for a specific audience. We had a consulting firm and we work with CEOs primarily. And so we said, we want every CEO to read this. And they said, and the publisher said, well, leaders, that's more broad. And we said, yeah, but the problem is there's a zillion books around leadership. Mm. We wanted one that was specifically for CEOs and aspiring CEOs. And that was the right call then. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, I also, when I sat down to write this book, I got really depressed because I thought, gee, I have all these business books that I didn't finish. I read about the first third and I decided, no, I'm going to write a fiction story that somebody will want to keep reading just to find out how it's going to end. And then they're going to remember it and they're going to go for there. So that's how I decided to write a fable. And this fable, unlike my others, is not, it's more allegorical, I think is the right word. And that is that it's a lot more, there's an element of, it just isn't like, it really truly is more of a fable than a business fiction book. Now we call all of our books fables, but they're really kind of, I try to write edgy, realistic fiction, but things happen in this that are more allegorical, and it reads more like a fable. So that's just a little setup to how this book came about.
And the only other thing I'll say before we get into the content, Pat, is, you know, we're 13 books later after this book. Depending on how you count. We always say 13, but I think you've written some other things.
Yeah.
But if someone were to go back, you say this often, is like, you don't write your books in sequential order. It's not like you went to a whiteboard, you know, 15 years ago or 20 years ago and said, here's all the books I'm going to write on leadership. And here's the first one. You just wrote this book, but you will often say, what's the first, just because this is the first one you wrote does not mean it's the first one people should read.
No, the first one they should read would probably be The Motive, because that's why you should get into leadership in the first place. You know, this would be pretty interesting for a leader to read.
Mm-hmm. I would hope so.
Yes. 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 You know, that's a good market. Leaders. But I mean, but if you were a leader, it would. But I wouldn't say to a team, you should all go read this book. And one of the reasons I say that is because this book was actually the precursor to The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And if you read them both, you're going to say, gosh, these look very similar. And that's because this was the first thing we did. And from that, we said, wait a second, there's an application to teams as well. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why it gets forgotten, because even if you've never read it, if you know The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, you kind of understand the theory here.
Great. Let's dive in.
All right.
Should we talk about the first temptation?
Yeah. And I want to talk about how this came about. I was working with a fairly large company, and I worked directly with the executive team, but I was also doing pro bono work for a few other firms just for fun at night. I was kind of moonlighting. But there was this one CEO I was working with who, even if the company he was running didn't make its number, and I remember they were struggling, and I'd go in to see him after we missed our numbers, and he would be in a good mood. And I was like, why is this guy in a good mood? They missed their number. And it was because he had gone on TV that day to talk to the analysts, and he did a really good job, and people thought he was funny, and he was able to divert the attention away from the numbers to something going on in the world. It wasn't his fault. And I remember thinking, he doesn't care about the numbers. Mm. He doesn't care about the results. Mm. He's actually more interested in his own status. Does he look cool, and do people like him? Mm. And I remember thinking, status over results. That's the one temptation of a CEO. I've got myself a book. No, I mean, I wasn't thinking about that. I just thought that's the problem with CEOs who don't succeed. They're too interested in their status. Hmm. So that's the first one. Now, what you'll notice is if you know the five dysfunctions of a team, I'm going backward.
Yeah.
Because that's the fifth thing we talk about in the dysfunction. So I kind of peel the onion in that direction.
Yeah. Hmm. It's interesting. The idea that you choose status over results or how you look. Obviously, there's the team application. We talk about like, oh boy, you should have your organization's hat on when you're sitting at the leadership team table, not your own, you know, position or salary or reputation. We use sports analogies a lot. It's a lot like a basketball player saying, "Well, I scored 30 points tonight, but our team lost,
and I'm going to make the All-Star team."
Right.
Exactly. And there's a lot, there are CEOs who do it that way.
Yeah. Pat, what's the motivation or fear that a leader might have that would have them choose this temptation or lean into this, that they're like, yeah, I'm going to make sure that my status is more important than the results? What's behind that?
Well, interestingly enough, and since we're talking about this in real time, I think it's the motive problem. I don't know if it's a fear thing. I think it's like they became a leader. And I think this person that I wrote about became a leader to be cool, to have fun. He really liked the attention. Mm-hmm. And frankly, if he made his numbers but didn't get the attention and the credit, that would have been a loss for him.
Yeah.
So I think truly I would have said, I don't think you're a leader for the right reason. Mm. And one day, 24 years from now, I'm going to write a book about that.
Yeah. It's that collective result. If the leader doesn't get credit for what has happened, it's not as interesting to them.
Absolutely. And the best leaders in the world are not famous, because they're more about helping the organization and the people in the organization succeed rather than getting attention.
I actually love, because we often get asked, like people will say, hey, who are the and I'm looking out at our PCs here, is like people will say, who are the best leaders of healthy organizations? And your answer I love is always like, well, you probably haven't heard of them, because they're not interested in just the status, or they're not interested in being known for that. They actually just want to humbly run the company and create a culture that dignifies people that work there. And so it is really interesting that you can't point to a famous, you know, CEO that really, you know, quite frankly, because they're not, I stutter a lot on this podcast that's happening live, because they're actually choosing the results of the organization over being famous.
Exactly. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy almost, if you will. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is after I saw that, I thought, well, wait a second. The CEO that preceded this guy, he wasn't interested in status at all. And I thought, why did he fail? And I remember thinking, because he wasn't willing, when other people on the team did the wrong things, he wasn't willing to hold them accountable because he wanted to be popular. He wanted to be well-liked. He didn't like the idea of like, okay, I'm not status-oriented, but some of these people are, and some of these people are doing the wrong things, and he didn't want to tell them they had to stop. And it was because he wanted to be liked. I know that sounds silly. It sounds like something a fifth grader would say, but it's all the way to the boardroom. It's true. He wanted to be liked, and he didn't want to be unpopular and say, hey, you can't do that anymore. And so he failed to get results, not because he was status-oriented, but because he wouldn't hold people accountable for their behaviors and their actions.
What does that look like when a leader is choosing popularity over accountability? Like tactically, week to week, what does that leader look like?
You know, it's funny. It comes down to silly things. And I love this. Alan Mulally, who, you know, was at Ford, he would hold people accountable for doing things like looking at their phone during meetings or having their laptop open or not paying attention or talking all the time. And literally things like that. So many, if you talk to most CEOs and go, why do you tolerate that those people in the room looking at their phone during your meetings? I don't know what they're going to say, but what they should really say is, I don't want to look like I'm telling them what to do. They're going to think I'm being a dick. Mm-hmm. Okay, since we have a live audience, we're going to go ahead and say that today. Yeah. And nobody wants to look like they're a jerk, but it's like, but that's your job, is to say, please put away your phones. It's kind of rude because we're all trying to solve the problems of this company, and yet you're doing something else that we don't know. So really what it comes down to, a lot of leaders don't want to be unpopular or for people to think they're a jerk, and so they just don't do it. And it's as simple as it can be. Again, it's go back to fifth grade, but...
Just an hour ago, probably in this room with many of our consultants, we had this whole conversation about when a leader uses their team to meet some of their emotional needs and wants, you know?
Yeah.
And one of the things, one of our consultants, Brian, said, oh, I had a leader say to me, well, I have to fire this person. How do I do it in a way that they still like me afterwards? You know, and that might be this is probably an example of someone saying, oh, I don't want to give them the whole truth or all of the feedback that they need, so that at the end of the day, I can feel liked by that team member or my team.
Right. And the irony is, if you do the right thing, they're going to respect you and probably like you truly. But if you need them to like you, then you're not going to do the right thing. And so it's not a bad thing to be well-liked and popular, except if you're acting in a way that makes that happen because you need it.
Yeah.
Well, I would even go a step further and say, the very act of doing true accountability, holding your team, this is what we talk about on this podcast all the time, is like, if you tell people the kind truth, that would actually garner more respect, kindness, like, appreciation from your team. And so the avoidance of that actually undermines even what they're trying to achieve. They want to be liked. And the best way to achieve that is actually to go tell the kind truth.
The thing is, in the short term, that's not necessarily the case. Like, if you need them to like you that day, that night, that week, that month, you have to. And so that's what a lot of people are doing. They're saying, but I want them to like me right now because I don't want to drive home tonight and think they're upset with me. So it's really a near-term thing. I don't think it's a long-term thing. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to everybody here? Okay, good. Because sometimes
resounding yes from the audience. Before we move on to the next one, I just would love, like, real practically, this one really resonates with me. I bet it resonates with a lot of people that, oh, I kind of want to be liked. Accountability is hard. What would you say practically to them to go and do?
You mean to overcome that?
Yeah.
I think it's to tell people that. I mean, Tracy and I had this early at the table group because I didn't like to give people negative feedback. I like to give them positive feedback. I mean, I like to encourage them. And then if they do something wrong, I don't think I want to talk about that because really I don't want to be uncomfortable. And I remember Tracy said to me early on in the table group, she said, tell me what I need to do to improve, because if you don't, that doesn't help me. And you think you're being nice, but it's actually not helpful. And so you need to actually, so the point is, tell your people, I don't like to tell people hard things. That's going to rob you of something you need. I'm being selfish. Please know that you can actually demand that I hold you accountable, because it's really a selfish thing not to do that.
We had a couple brand new principal consultants that joined the practice, and we were in a room yesterday kind of walking through some of the models. And one of the things that we talked about around accountability is the idea of like letting a little air out of the balloon as quickly as possible. Like a lot of leaders, you know, I use that analogy, like if you get an email and you don't answer it for 2 days, and then you don't answer it for a week, and then 30 days goes by and you're like, well, I can't answer this now. They'll know I've ignored them forever. I have to quit my job and get a new email. You know, like that's the only answer here. But accountability, it gets a lot harder the longer you wait. When you're asking for practical advice for leaders, it's like, hey, the sooner you can get right to that conversation it lets the air out of the balloon so quickly that it doesn't have time to build up. It's just like, it's hard to do the first time, but after a little bit, it's just like, hey, we talked about that. You're late for this meeting. It gets easier and easier the faster you do it.
And I think it's a great way. The advice I'd give to people is say to somebody, hey, I need to give you some feedback. This is hard for me. I'm not very good at it. To me, when I give a talk, I always tell people if I'm nervous, I start by going, I'm kind of nervous. And then right. Suddenly they're there. And if I say, Tracy, I got to give you some feedback. You know, this is hard for me. Suddenly she's like, oh, okay, let's do it.
Yeah.
But if I, so just let people know what you're thinking. And if you're not good at it, tell them that. It really helps.
That's great. So you witnessed two leaders and saw two temptations. I'm guessing there's a third leader and a third temptation because the book is called The Five Temptations. So
that's right. But I won't say it's not like there's five characters because I think what happened is we were just thinking about this today. I'd almost forgotten this. I think it was then I went back to why would a person theoretically not want to hold people accountable? And I thought about it. I thought because if they don't know what to hold them accountable for, they're not going to do it. And that's, they valued certainty. And you'd say, because the first leader also had this temptation. And we'd go like, we need to make a decision at the firm. Like we have to settle on a marketing message. I remember this. And he was like, I'm not ready yet. And he was like in the position for 14 months and he was still not willing to make a call.
Yeah.
And that's because certain people value certainty. Like I know that I have the right answer over clarity. Mm-hmm. And what this has to do with accountability is if I don't know exactly what Andrew's goals should be, or I don't know what Al should be working on, mm-hmm. how can I hold them accountable? And it's like, well, pick something, make a decision, make clarity happen, and then you will have the courage to hold them accountable. But you might be wrong, but it's still better to have a wrong answer and have something to work off of than to be, you know, uncertain.
And do you think leaders don't do that because the answer is really hard to find? Do you think it's a fear that they might have picked the wrong thing? What is underneath that?
Yeah, I think it's the fear of somebody going, hey, you were wrong. Mm-hmm. And a leader has to be humble enough, this gets to the motive, and go, yeah, I was, wasn't I? Mm. And so I think a lot of people take a lot of pride in being precise and being intellectually true and correct. And if you value that, and there's certain personality types that do that more than others, but there's certain people that think, I'm supposed to have the right answer. Now, that's not one of mine. I'm actually very comfortable having the wrong answer. I do it all the time. But
confidently.
Confidently, yes, yes. I never admit it, by the way. No, but so I think the best leaders are the ones that go, yeah, we're going to make 10 decisions and seven of them will be good and three won't be, but we'll learn from that. And so some people really value precision and accuracy. And so that's a very natural temptation.
Do you think that leaders assume that their direct reports, their team, they want specific, precise direction? Do you think is that some of the hesitation that they're like, oh, my people need certainty. They need to know exactly the plan.
Yeah. Now you've entered two things that are similar, but they're different. One is specificity and the other is clarity. And I think what they want is clarity, directional clarity, and say, this is where we're heading. That's currently the goal. Let's move in that direction. But it probably won't be, we talked about this earlier today, it probably won't be exactly like that, but giving you clarity and marching forward. And I heard this was a military thing, and they said, you know, a good plan well executed is better than a perfect plan executed too late. The other thing I heard is that if you're on the battlefield and you're not sure the right thing to do, pick something and get people moving because they'll learn from their actions. Where if you sit in the foxhole and keep doing analysis, it paralyzes you and you're much more likely to get killed. Now, I've never been in the military, so I don't know what that means, but I know the same thing seems to apply in companies. Pick something and start moving and you'll learn more from that.
I think it's interesting. So we've now gone through three: choosing status over results, choosing popularity over accountability, and then choosing certainty over clarity. And you use this word, pride, which is around certainty over clarity, which is like, I don't want to be wrong. But actually, pride is really linked to all three of these.
Oh, it's
right?
The like root of all sin, right?
Right. And so it's like, oh, I want to be proud, or I have pride in being liked, or I have pride in looking good on TV, even if my company's failing. So there's so much that's wrapped into this that I love that we started with the motive, because if you get that wrong, how could you do any of this stuff?
Right. Mm. And there are people, that's why I said what I really came to this. Karen and I were in Palm Springs once working with all these CEOs, and I was giving them advice around this kind of stuff. And there, some of them were looking at me like, well, I wouldn't do that. Why would I care? And I was like, oh my gosh, they're leading for the wrong reason. That's where the motive came from. Mm-hmm. Some of them are like, no, I do this for my own power or my money or my attention or my ego. And if that's the case, then none of this that we're talking about makes sense.
It makes me think about what the title of the book is, The Five Temptations of a CEO, not The Five Temptations of a Terrible CEO. More than likely, every CEO has, every leader has wrestled with all five of these. And so if pride is kind of the root of why they're happening, humility is probably the first step towards recovery for all of them. Like you said, around accountability, just say, I'm terrible at this. Or around clarity of, I'm tempted right now, guys, to want to have the perfect answer rather than the clear answer.
Right. Well, and somebody here said before, you know, temptation and sin are different things. We don't want to give in to these temptations, but to deny that we're tempted by one or more of them is making us more likely to give into it. Mm-hmm. We have to know it. We have to know, oh, there's my temptation to be precise, to be exact, to be correct. It's preventing me from giving people clarity.
Yeah.
So being aware of the fact that we're all tempted, we all have temptations.
Mm-hmm.
Now we'll go to the next one,
yep,
which is before the temptation, why wouldn't a person want to create clarity, and what do they need to do if they don't know the answer? Like, all the data is not perfect. Well, the way to do that is to crowdsource, right? Is to get in a room and have people have conflict and argue and debate so that you can actually arrive at something that's clear, yeah, and it's the best attempt at certainty. But there's people that don't like conflict because they're afraid somebody's going to get hurt. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good intention poorly executed. And that is, they're afraid, like, that's why it's harmony over conflict. Conflict is necessary to get clarity. But if you're really worried that somebody's feelings are going to get hurt and you're trying to protect people from that. So one of the CEOs I mentioned before, I'll never forget this day. I would go to the executive team meetings at this big company, and they were boring as hell. They were just so boring. And that, you know, later the death by meeting came about. But one day they started to argue, and I thought, this is interesting. And they were really frustrated with one another, but they were arguing, and the CEO pushed away from his desk, from the table, and walked out of the room and said, I don't want to hear this anymore. And I thought, that's the last interesting meeting they're ever going to have.
Hmm.
So, and he was a good guy. He was like, oh no, somebody's going to say something rude to somebody. And he was actually making a trade-off between that and getting at clarity.
Hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so we've got our PCs here in the room, and we got some questions from some of them. So we're going to take one of those questions right now before we get to the fifth temptation, because it relates to this. So we've got Mike Snelling here. Mike's going to speak into the mic and ask us his question. Hi, Mike.
Hey, team. Pat, thanks for the insights. I'll go closer to the mic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We can edit that out.
Yeah, so. We have to get really close to the mic.
Okay, there you go.
Want to hear your awesome accent.
Well, I'm crapping myself, but
you can also put that
keep that in.
Okay. Yeah. So this is the forgotten first book, and we're learning about the temptations again, which is wonderful. My question is, how does your current thoughts on courage, which you've been talking about recently, give us insights into these temptations as well? So it's joining some of your thoughts from 1998, which is the forgotten first book, through to 2023 now, when you're thinking about courage.
Wow, that's a great question, and this is live and real. I think courage, the motive plays into this, because if your motive is bad, why would you have courage? It's a risk. And so I do think courage relates to a lot of these things, and it's the courage to be, but the different kind, the courage to be wrong, the courage to be unpopular, the courage to have people get emotional. I do think courage is a big part of that. What do you think, Mike? I mean, you asked the question, you probably have some thoughts about that. I think there's something to this.
Correct.
No, tell me, because I'm hearing this for the first time, so tell me what your thoughts are, how courage plays into this.
I'm just thinking, you talked about there's three types of courage, and the courage, I guess, to tell yourself what temptations are most likely to be getting in the way right now. Maybe to tell others, in terms of having encouragement for others of how to mitigate that or move around that. And also, which of these is probably likely to get you first as a leader? You know, even if you're responsibility-based rather than reward-based,
Right.
Which is going to, which would be the most likely to get you first.
So I love this. We were going to do a presentation later today during our conference, and I'm going to do it now during our podcast. So there's the three types of courage that is the personal courage that you're looking in the mirror and you're going, am I being true about who I am and what my fears are and all those things? We got to have that. And if you don't have personal courage, you're never going to confront your temptations. Mm-hmm. Interpersonal courage really plays into the accountability one, and that is, am I going to say something that's to a group of people or to one person that is difficult for them to hear, and am I going to be okay to do that and let the chips fall where they may? And the last one is what we call public courage. This might be making a statement to the entire team or to the entire company where you are taking a risk and saying something that they might not respond positively to, but you believe it, you think it's the right thing to do. I'm not sure where that falls. This is more individual. That's probably gets into more the five dysfunctions of a team and other things. So I think you've just convinced me that courage is at the heart of this, but the three different kinds of courage play out differently. Now, I will say this. The second kind of courage, interpersonal, is the one I think that lacks most in most companies in our society. Mm-hmm. I think it's easier for people to stand up sometimes on a stage or to send out a tweet to 100 people, but not to go to two people sitting at a table and go, I disagree with you and I think that's going to be harmful and I want to tell you why. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that gets directly at the accountability one. You got to speak the truth to people in love, and that's how they're going to respect you.
And so, I would add that even the way that leaders are listening to this, the whole reason we're even doing this at this retreat is because one of our principal consultants, David Hoyt, he actually just stood up right before we hit record and said, hey, this was the most convicting book that I've ever read. He had the personal courage to say, I'm actually 5 for 5 on these temptations and do the hard work of confronting those temptations and then becoming a better leader as a result.
Yeah, I don't think there's anybody that isn't susceptible to all five of these in some way, although some of them will scream at you like, that's yours or those two. And so I think having the courage to look at yourself first and then the courage to talk to other people, I think that's a great application. And thank you for your wonderful accent, Mike. I appreciate that.
Yes.
On behalf of all of North America, we want to appreciate the English accent.
You're very welcome.
That could be our unpaid ad today, but it's not. Yeah. We have one. Yeah,
it's for the 4th of July. So
thank you, Mike.
Yeah.
I can't believe you just said that.
Keep it in. I will say, because I want to get to the last one, but to go back to choosing harmony over productive conflict, there's a room full of principal consultants here who would love to go to a flip chart right now and draw the conflict continuum. I wanted to talk about one thing that you just said, which is people always say tell us the story of the leader or the team that's having so much, all this conflict, threw a chair at a wall. And we have to constantly, unfortunately, say, we wish it was that exciting. Way more teams and way more leaders live far too much on the artificial harmony side than they do on the productive conflict side.
You know, and it's so funny. I think that's because of television and movies. Because every movie or TV show we watch about business, because it has to be interesting, they show people yelling at each other, being all political and mean. And so people are like, tell me a story. And I'm like, I wish people did that more, just purely for my entertainment. I mean, because what they do instead is they avoid conflict at all costs, which is just as dangerous. It's just boring.
Yeah.
And so I think that you're absolutely right. Far more people live on that side of the pool where we have artificial harmony, where we pretend like we all like each other and get along. And then we go out in the parking lot after and complain about one another. And the other side of the equation where people are just at each other's throats rarely happens. And when it does, it makes for some pretty darn good stories.
Yeah, you just described the most interesting meeting that team had and the leader had to leave the room. That is far more common to be like, oh, hey, we're getting into a little bit of conflict. I'm going to back out of this. And then also sends a message to the rest of the team. Hey, by the way, let's never have conflict again in our meetings.
Yeah, if you passionately disagree, you're doing something wrong. What a great way to destroy a company, right? By the way, I should just say all these people in the room, they come from all over the world and they work with every kind of company that you can imagine. And it's crazy to hear the stories they tell because I've been doing this work for, 27 years, but the stories they tell and the kind of companies they work with and the things they're doing exceed anything that I could have imagined. And so it's a really interesting thing. And if you're looking for somebody to work with your CEO and to do that, these are the people to do it.
Yeah.
Tablegroup.com.
That's okay. Great. Pat, you want to tell us about the fifth temptation?
Yeah, which is the inverse of the five dysfunctions, right? The fifth temptation is, why don't people want to have conflict? Why don't they want people to mix it up and get messy? And it's because they really want to be in control. They don't want the vulnerability of things getting out of hand. So what they're doing is they're choosing invulnerability, in other words, not being out of control, over the trust and the vulnerability. It's really invulnerability over vulnerability, which is required for trust. So you're the CEO and you're sitting in a meeting and you're thinking, oh my gosh, if these people start to argue and somebody gets their feelings hurt, I've lost control. Mm. I better pretend like it's all together. I'm always in control and I always have this figured out. And that, of course, leads people not to be able to trust them, because we all want to crap ourselves sometimes at a meeting, you know, using Mike's terminology. Is that what they say in Britain? Is that in UK?
Yeah.
It's normally worse. Okay, got it. So anyway, that's the last one. So when you look at this, we came up with this and we started working with CEOs, and then we go work with their team and we'd go, oh, wait, it goes the other direction, right? First, we have to build trust by getting people to be vulnerable so that they'll engage in conflict and not worry about harmony, because harmony is dangerous. And that will give them clarity, which we call commitment. So we create clarity that they actually commit to. So that's where the language differs. And that will give them the courage to hold people accountable. Yeah. And that is what will allow you to get results regardless of the temptation to status. And now that I go through it that way, it really makes more sense. I haven't thought about this in years, but that is where we made all the connections. So this little book is really the parent or the grandparent of the five dysfunctions.
You should read it, Bo. It's pretty good.
I look forward to it. Yeah. It's one of the best books I'm going to read in the future.
Did you hear about that? Somebody endorsed a book. Jeff Foxworthy. And on the book it said,
probably the best book ever written. I can't wait to read it.
Right.
Fantastic.
So you can say that.
Okay, we do have an unpaid ad, but before that, we've got another question from one of our amazing consultants with this thick Boise, Idaho accent, Mike McCarg.
Another Mike. All of our consultants, Mike's.
All right, Pat. So which of the five temptations, as the CEO of the table group, is the most tempting for you?
Oh, no doubt about it. It's choosing popularity over accountability. Mm-hmm. As I like to say to people, that's because...
But he's not that popular, honestly.
No. I know. That's the irony.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. I like to say, like, if you've studied graduate level psychology or business, you know that people like me, CEOs that have a hard time with this, are called wusses. Mm-hmm. And I'm a wuss because I love the people I work with. And probably we go back to Brian's stuff. Like, I started when I was younger and I needed them to like me more. And so I was like, oh no, I can't risk them not doing that. And now I realize, no, if I care about them, I remember that day I said, it was selfish of me not to do that. If I love them, I'll tell them, I'll risk my popularity. And that will make our relationship stronger. So it's definitely that one. When I look at the others, yeah, I think that's the biggie. I can relate to all of them, but I like it when people argue at the table because I know that's good, but that one I'm really bad at.
Has it changed over time, or has that always been the one that's the biggest challenge for you?
Always been, and I think probably always will. Yeah. But I've really worked on it. Mm-hmm. But it's still down there.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's in my wounds. It's in my working genius, my Myers-Briggs. Like, you look at the whole person of who I am, that one probably makes the most sense. And if I were to talk to somebody else who had a different Myers-Briggs type and a different working genius and a different past experience and they study different things, if you're an engineer who's an NT and all that, theirs might be certainty over clarity. Mm-hmm. You know, like in working genius, if you're in IT, you know, you're very precise and you like to map things out. And so it might be harder to be messy.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. That's a great question.
Okay, we've got another question from Julio. Where is Julio? He's back in the back.
All right. Y él va a preguntarlo en español.
Lo podemos preguntar en español. Okay, so my question is, and this is related. I was recently with the team, and they were having a hard time helping their CEO see his struggle. So my question is, how can a leadership team or a leadership team member help their CEO see their area of struggle or their temptation? Mm.
You know, I think that's why it's so important to understand that everybody has them. And I believe, and I always say this, that my career trajectory was based on the fact that people pushed me into the CEO's office and said, you tell him or you tell her. And I would be like, why? And they go, because he listens to you. And I thought, why is that? And it was because I really embraced this thing called the kind truth. And if you can go to somebody and say, hey, you know something? All of us get tempted as leaders. And I'm not saying I'm a better leader than you. I struggle with some of these things, but I read this and it really helped me identify some things. And I think it could help you too, because I see some things that you might struggle with, but don't think I'm telling you I'm smarter than you or better than you. Every leader I've ever worked with has struggled with this. So if you can relate to them and make them not feel like it's too risky, but then say, I think you could go over these. You might even say, I think this one might be a struggle for you. This one over here is a struggle for me. I think sometimes we forget that when we manage upward, it's not really upward. There, we have to minister to people who are in authority over us too. And they are just boys and girls that are older, that are just as struggling as everybody else. And when we can treat them that way, most CEOs, most leaders will say, thank you for having the courage to tell me that. And I like to say, if you do that 10 times, 5 times the CEO is going to say, thank you for telling me. 4 times they're going to ignore you and say, I don't really care. And 1 time they're going to fire you. And it's, I mean, honestly, and you don't want to work for the guy that would fire you for kindly telling her or him the truth.
It also speaks to me, you said this earlier today, Pat, that we shouldn't assume that leaders are leading the way they want to.
Right. Yeah, we always assume, well, you must be doing that because that's exactly how you want to be. Yeah. And it's almost never the case. I mean, and think about yourself. Do you always manage the way you want to? Are you always at your best? No. And when people say, hey, this could work better for you, you're like, ooh, thanks for telling me.
All love right. it.
Julio?
Julio, thank you.
Gracias.
Okay.
Julio is from Costa Rica, by the way, we should say. We're not just speaking Spanish to some random dude.
There's a voice actor. It's all a voice actor.
Yeah.
Okay. One more. You want to do one more?
Yes.
Okay. Casey.
Come on up,
Thompson.
Casey.
Oh, no.
Here we go.
See if you recognize this voice.
A voice for podcasts. And a face for podcasts as well.
This is Cody's twin brother, Casey, and they talk a lot alike.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Here, I'll...
I don't think he meant it as a compliment for either of you.
Yeah. I will ask the question.
No. Okay, so as a leader, we work with a lot of executives. If they read The Motive, they read The Five Temptations. It's really exposing potential weaknesses or cracks in leadership that they're susceptible to. It's already the loneliest position in the world. How would you recommend they get support or feel supported?
Well, that's why it's so great to have a coach or a consultant who will tell
and
you the truth.
And we'll tell you half of them in here are.
Yeah, yeah. No. We've got like 25 of them right here. So it's 50-50, you know. But again, it's not somebody who's going to affirm them and everything. And that's so tempting. We were talking about this today. Even as a consultant, you kind of want to tell a client, you want to make them feel better. And sometimes the way to feel better is to love them enough to tell them what they need to hear, but to be with them in that. So you're not like, hey, I'm going to do a drive-by here and tell you, you're bad at number 3, bye. You know? You're going to be like, yeah, let's work on this, because every leader I've ever worked with struggles with one or two of these. And so I'm going to sit with you in this, and I'm going to love you through this. Now, we don't say it that way all the time, but that's really what it is. Mm-hmm. And one of our consultants was telling us today about how many times people say, I just don't want to be alone in this.
Yeah.
And you're not meant to be. None of us are meant to be alone. And that's why it's really good to have a person that you trust that you can share in this stuff with.
Yeah, and I think the first step for leaders would be the vulnerability piece, right? Being willing to ask for help is the first step. And then being able to find that trusted advisor or someone that you could actually expose yourself to and then feel supported in that accountability.
Absolutely. And you can get some of that from your team. I mean, it would be silly to think that they can't love you too. But if that's your primary source of affirmation, then they're going to, that's too confusing. So having that person that you can go to, a coach, a counselor, a therapist, a friend, an informed friend, and say, I need you to help me do this, is absolutely the right thing to do.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Get off the podcast.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, Pat, I think we have an unpaid ad today that came to us from the consultants. We kind of crowdsourced this. And
yeah, we
asked
said to them, what makes such a difference for you all that you want to tell the world about?
And they said the Oxford comma. We said, that one's already been taken. So do you have any other ideas?
Celery at offsites. That's a big one. No. Cody, what's the unpaid ad?
So this is the one of the primary tools that we use is the 3M sticky flip chart. So we go into rooms, we transform organizations with markers and these little 3M stickies that are all over the room we're in right now, draw the models on them and hang them up. And specifically, our consultant said, don't say the generic brand, it's got to be 3M, because you get an hour into an offsite with a generic brand and the things start falling off the walls, it causes all sorts of chaos, people get confused. So 3M sticky flip chart.
You know something? I still think a flip chart is one of the most powerful tools in business. And there's all this technology and we love technology, but sometimes, darn it, you just need something on the wall that you can write on and remember. And it's a big part of everything that we do. And I like to say, I don't really bring slides. I just give me a flip chart and a pen and we're off to the races. So way to go, 3M, the mining company of Minnesota developed that. So we appreciate that. All right, that's the end of our podcast today. We want to thank you all for listening, and we want to thank all of our consultants for being here. Thank you, everybody. And we will talk to you next time on At the Table. God bless.